Chapter 16. Science's Empty Silos. I don't like it, and I am sorry I had anything to do with it. Erwin Schrödinger, Nobel Prize winner, an unhappy quantum physicist. Just before I left the army, I read my first book on evolutionary psychology, The Moral Animal, by Robert Wright. At last, I felt that someone was putting their finger on the way, at that time, that I thought about things. This new field and its sister, evolutionary biology, grabbed my attention, in particular works by E.O. Wilson and Ernst Mayr. Whilst in the army, I had read several of Darwin's books and admired his detailed analysis of evidence, but Wright's work sparked a deeper interest in science and evolution, particularly their relationship to history. As I then planned to become involved in defending democracy by writing books attacking the already badly wounded communists, I wanted to be able to argue from a solid and wide base of knowledge, so I made my plans and began studying life from the genesis of the eyeball up until the present. Along with evolution, I started reading global histories, which at that time was a subject not covered as comprehensively as it is now, and I began with a classic volume, The Rise of the West, by William H. McNeill, though dated even then. I also studied the major religions, going back to their basic texts to get an understanding of their mores, and this has given me a much better appreciation for other civilizations and peoples, things that I could relate to as a constant traveler since infancy. Of course, the ends of religion and science are not the same, and as scientists are often atheists, tolerance and understanding are required by both groups, one toward the other. However, as tolerance is not a feeling that naturally occurs, as the chimps and encounters throughout human history have demonstrated, this seems to be in short supply, including in many of my fellow skeptics. I would remind them that the Reformation was largely a bloodletting over differences of opinion and not only religious. The secular leader that protected Luther had his own reasons for doing so, and many seemingly religious conflicts are sometimes little more than secular spats with religion as a part of the mix. Such scenarios have been more common than realized, with hidden motives not always taken account of or lost in the craven court historians' renditions of the times. However, historical studies are really benefiting from the recent advances in science, especially with DNA analysis allowing the extraction of samples that are hundreds of thousands of years old, but which can still be analyzed. The revelations they bring are turning over ancient texts and assumptions with deep significance. It's a wonderful time to have an open mind. True tolerance in the West only began its difficult birth when Christians had to develop freedoms to stem the tide of blood, war, and misery let loose after Luther took his stand. Eventually, the terror abated, and we found a way to live together by allowing greater freedom of conscience, speech, the press, assembly, and the right to petition government. These big five were captured in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the lead-in to the Bill of Rights. This simple document comprises the first 10 amendments to that great but now much ignored Constitution, and each of the amendments is only one paragraph in length, a wonderful ABC literary creation, if ever there was one. Whilst I admire the American Constitution, I have my doubts about the value of written constitutions, as it seems to me that they end up with lawyers in a Supreme Court becoming overmighty, with no democratic sanctions to hobble them. At least with Britain's unwritten constitution, it retains a direct link to the people and is a political rather than a legal beast. Lawyers are too picky for me, and I prefer the prudence and the practical intelligence of the people to sort out our thorny issues, not leaving them to a minority of aged and out-of-touch Whigs. As noted previously, my fellow faithless, but mainly so they claimed, science-based types of the communist variety spent decades killing tens of millions in their forlorn search for heaven on earth. It's a pity they didn't leave them alone to find it in the afterlife. Or not. I look on belief as largely a matter of geography, as where one was born and raised has a considerable bearing on the likelihood of one's convictions. However, as more and more faiths are being followed in the West, competition is underway for converts and numbers. The mass movements of people are now encouraged by globalist planners, particularly of the arrogant elect in the East Coast elite and the institutions they established. "God gave me my wealth," John D. Rockefeller Sr. once responded to critics who demanded he admit the tainted character of his vast fortune. Foundation leaders are overwhelmingly drawn from among the believers, Protestants, an elect group, the chosen few, in their own eyes, the real owners of America. They may have begun with God as one of the justifications for their driving forces, but today I am not so sure. The original globalist motivation has survived, and the U.S. corporates and their masters have just carried on doing what they have always done, so long as it still turns a buck. These self-regarding plutocrats were recognized long ago by Adam Smith for what they are and how they corrupt nations. The sneaking art of underling tradesmen are thus erected into political maxims for the conduct of a great empire. Maybe better the shopkeepers than the socialists, but better still that the wisdom of all of us is used to set out our nation's stall. Bernays' covert power brokers among the American magnates are still doing all they can to monopolize the global market and funnel the profits into fewer pockets, whilst markedly reducing the chances for their fellow Americans to live the dream. Despite the U.S. having almost four times the population of Germany, those Europeans have more actual billionaires than the U.S., as there are fewer mouths in the trough, but they are larger and more voracious. Sadly, if you are an American dreamer, it looks like you may need to move. It is this elect that continues to use the grand area plan that their hirelings in the CFR devised to carry out the global resource grab, and this has undoubtedly elevated America to becoming the premier power in the world. In order to push this agenda, the family foundations used their networks to construct the new academic discipline of international relations, developing the realist school. These well-funded hothouses produce academics that reflect the aims of the elites, policing and controlling the states, physically sitting atop the assets that the U.S. needs to strip out to power their economy. One of their favored professors in a 1942 Yale publication informed us that there is no region of the globe that is too distant to be without strategic significance, too remote to be neglected in the calculations of power politics. Permanent war on a global scale. Here is Yale's contribution to U.S. grand strategy. It is not a conspiracy theory to refer to the global aims of the U.S. and its foundation-funded plans to dominate the planet and so ensure access to resources. It is a history of a strategy. The real power of the elite-directed foundations in the universities was observed by Harold Laski, chairman of the UK's Labour Party in 1945-46, who had previously lectured at Harvard and Yale. Whilst there, he saw that, and the foundations do not control simply because, in the direct and simple sense of the word, there is no need for them to do so. They have only to indicate the immediate direction of their minds for the whole university world, to discover that it always meant to gravitate swiftly to that angle of the intellectual compass. You have to admire the integrity, independence, and courage of the academy in its pursuit of tenure, largesse, and status. The power of the foundations is further demonstrated when one thinks back to the interlocking directorships that Louis Brandeis pointed out when the Fed was foisted on the Americans. Having financiers on the board with interlocking directorships will limit the options and choices they support in their transactions, adversely affecting the competitiveness of the companies they represent and raising prices for the clients. The same players have just transferred this methodology to the boards of the Big Three and other foundations. And this is how the elite have maintained a cohesive front and their grasp on power, as Palmer noted concerning John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s activities. Jr. weaved Rockefeller interests into the very institutional fabric of American life. It was through such interlocking that the attitudes of a small section of the United States predominated culturally and otherwise. Palmer, 2014, PUA 49. Gabriel Kolko also noted that by 1955, the 200 top non-financial companies, most of which dominated their respective industries as price and policy leaders, directly owned 43.0% of the total assets of 435,000 non-financial corporations. This amounted to at least 18.3% of the total national reproducible tangible assets of $891 billion. These corporations were controlled by approximately 2,500 men and probably even fewer. These men, in both direct ownership of economic assets and control over the corporate structure, are the most important single group in the American economic elite. When one tabulates the number of directorships in corporations of every size held by the directors of the top 200 corporations, a pattern of extensive interlocking directorships emerges, involving a very large percentage of the top directors. Here, then, is the dominant fact of economic control. The top 200 corporations cooperate with each other and exert influence within innumerable smaller companies. Don't forget, this was from decades ago, but illustrates the strategy which has now infested the global system, as demonstrated earlier, with over half the shares of the 299 largest corporations in the world owned by just 30 companies. How many directors does that leave in control now? It was less than 2,500 men for the 200 U.S. corporations. So, how many for the 30 global powerhouses? This incredible and globally significant influence has no chance of being highlighted in the power elite-owned media, and the strategy is reflected in the foundations too, as can be seen when looking at what Hillary referred to as the mothership, the CFR. The elitist Council on Foreign Relations received one quarter of its income in 1961 from the Big Three. At the very same time, on the CFR's membership roster were 10 of the 14 Carnegie, 10 of the 15 Ford, and 12 of the 20 Rockefeller trustees, almost half of all top foreign policy officials in Washington, D.C. between 1945 and 1972 were CFR members. Some years ago, Vice President Biden was in the CFR and boasted of having removed the Ukrainian prosecutor who was looking a little too closely for comfort into some financial affairs that might have turned up something close to home. That is the Biden family. He claimed to have done so by threatening to withhold $1 billion in aid if the pesky investigator wasn't shown the door. It shows how relaxed and at home these boondogglers are when reporting into their crew. Happy to let their hair down and loosen their tongues. Their plans are real, the strategies to direct the education of the masses clearly expressed and the resources allocated. But what if the people in the U.S. had a vote on establishing the hybrid? If Trump, DeSantis, or Kennedy were serious about freeing the nation from its controlling elite and its deep state operators, they would back national advisory referendums and a drive for the adoption of a hybrid system, would they not? This would also hand back greater powers and funds to the states, as localization is a natural outcome of the hybrid and has proven crucial to the Swiss success. Where folks see their taxes in use locally, interest and involvement increase. Would the statists allow such changes? Would the deep state believe that the introduction of such uncertainty cannot be allowed? Pliable party politicians can be easily incentivized, but a nation's entire populace. They need persuading, so what then? In their supposed pursuit of a democratic globe, will they try to crush those at home seeking the hybrid? What do the social scientists created by the many-headed Hydra foundations have to say about this? I would also note that numerous university subjects gifting themselves the title of science are nothing of the sort. Science can help inform the pseudosciences, but the core of such subjects often remains the odd and unfathomable human being, the repository of strong emotions as well as the ability to reason. There is no full understanding of our consciousness and capabilities, let alone the origin of our universe, hence the economists' reliance on forecasts of man's behaviors leading directly to the failure to foresee most of the sudden ups and downs of the economy. The only economists who seem to get close are the non-mainstream and dark horse outsiders who rely on experience and a good understanding of numbers, but the latter remains the bedrock and the former the shifting sands. There is no real military science either, hence why the most storied book on the subject is still Sun Tzu's The Art of War. In Chapter 3, I covered some of these issues as they were presented in science fictions, which shows that some science is not as scientific as they would have us believe. I also believe that the COVID responses can hardly be thought of as evidence-based either, as Matt Hancock's desire to scare the hell out of us makes eminently clear. Where were the senior scientists, medical officers, and public health officials publicly upbraiding him for his performances? Cowering, sloping shoulders, and looking away. This is the problem. Science is studied and overseen by fallible humans, and most appear to me to lack the integrity and courage expected of a corporal leading a section on a trench assault. Yes, this might be asking a lot, but the crisis became a national and international disaster precisely because craven officials lacked the guts to do what needed to be done. And this is not the only disaster in which foundation fund-hunting boffins have failed to show up. On this occasion, they let our economies crash and watched as many thousands of businesses closed forever needlessly. Worse, how many died because of their mishandling and how many took their own lives in despair? And this came on the back of another crisis of monumental proportions and one which appears to be as much of a hocus-pocus affair as the Wu Flu crisis. Christopher Booker wrote Global Warming, a case study in groupthink in 2018, and it's an education on the alignment of scientists, activists, and politicians pushing the global warming, apologies, climate change narrative. Interestingly, the book is not listed on his Wikipedia entry, maybe because it assembles a great deal of evidence countering the climate change assertions. Not only that, the Wikipedia entry is generally dismissive of Booker's other works, damning with faint praise, despite substantial figures giving him sterling reviews. Just another indication of alternative or objective arguments and evidence being undermined at every turn. However, the scientists who are prepared to fake data in this disputed specialism are criminal in their behavior, defrauding taxpayers around the world in pursuit of the aims of the new cult religion. Booker demonstrates that the deliberate faking of temperature rises and falls by scientists around the world is common, but who cares? The creative climate accountants in NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies adjusted records in South America between 1950 and 2014, stating that there had been a steep average rise of 1. 5C. But the archived data giving the temperatures originally recorded during those decades had not just shown no rise, they had shown a cooling trend amounting to a full degree. The way this had been done became only too clear. In each case, temperatures given for the earlier years had been retrospectively adjusted downwards from those originally recorded, while more recent temperatures had been adjusted upwards. Thus, had the picture given by the original data been turned upside down. it gets worse and more criminal. Giss had also fiddled the figures for the Arctic Circle, Australia, Canada, Iceland, Ireland, New Zealand, and Russia, all to the advantage of the cultists. So serious were the implications of all these discoveries that it might have been thought that they would provoke widespread concern, particularly when GIS and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, were asked to explain the reason for these systematic adjustments, and no convincing answer was forthcoming. But for those within the consensus's bubble, including scientists, politicians, and the media, it seemed it was best that these startling revelations should simply be ignored. That is, lie by omission. Over a decade earlier, Mrs. Thatcher had seen through the scam that these researchers had identified. She had been lauded in 1988 as the first influential leader to support the emerging climate consensus. But 15 years later, it was a different story. She had come to recognize how distortions of the science had been used to mask an anti-capitalist, left-wing political agenda that posed a serious threat to the progress and prosperity of mankind. Not one newspaper reported this remarkable U-turn by the lady not for turning. And 7 years later, David Cameron was still being praised by supporters of the consensus as a true Thatcherite for his green policies on climate change. And let's see how a good investigator might have graded the information being offered up by these arithmetical alchemists, able at will to turn a minus into a plus. For fake news mudslingers out there, a useful note on how you might analyze information using a simple, realistic, and open grading system. However, I don't worry about journalists' opinions too much, considering what one of our leading KCs has to say about their professionalism. In Lawfare, Jeffrey Robertson, KC, details the problems that Section 170 of the Data Protection Act poses for whistleblowers. Parliament did not debate Section 170, and the media itself and none of its investigative journalists bothered to lobby against it or report on its dangers, for all their ethical codes that require the protection of sources. So how could you start grading GIS and its data transitioning system? Let's have a look at a simple and influential tool that comes from the legal profession, in this case the jurists and scholars of Islam, the ulama. Any piece of information has two basic elements to it, the source from which it came and the information itself. The source, for example, may be an informant at a face-to-face meeting, a video clip on a social media site, or a report from a formerly reputable government department, you know, like GIS. These can be graded based upon the past performance of the individual, the site, or the department. As the sources can be graded on their reliability, so too can the information be graded, but obviously based on different criteria. Keeping things simple makes this grading system more useful than introducing complex algorithms that can just be tweaked by a programmer. So we can start by looking at how Muslim scholars graded the sources from which they received the information they used in the hadiths, the utterances, actions, and silent approvals of their prophet. It was not only the individual sees they spoke to that they had to assess, but those in the chain down which the stories had come down to them. The jurists referred to them as the chain of authorities. These informants, past and present, and corroboration from others regaling the hadith hunters with their version of the same incident, could be lumped into a simple grading of the reliability of the individuals and the chain down which the information came, ending up with a simple and overall grading of the sources of good, fair, or weak. There's that three again. A similar measurement and grading process would be used for the information or text, métier. The knowledge and expertise of the assessors provided them with the means to arrive at a similar three-choice grading, Then, by combining the source assessment and the information's assessed veracity, the experienced jurists and scholars could arrive at an overall grading, once more of good, fair, or weak. I think that many media outlets, both mainstream and alternative, would find their scoring in the weak section, but with the establishment media suffering more heavily than they did at any time in the past. A good portion of the alternatives, such as Joe Rogan, are now more professional, open, and questioning than the likes, for example, of CNN and the BBC. It reminds me of the differences between the English and Scottish universities in the past, with the Scots throwing the doors open to non-conformists, hence the famous Scottish and not the English Enlightenment. But will the establishment press learn from this? Truth is, they have nothing to learn, as many know that they are feeding the line of their employers, Big Pharma, providing 75% of the advertising revenue on primetime news on US mainstream outlets, for example. This ready reckoner is a useful guide for those interested in gauging the news they catch on the telly or in the tabloids. In the intelligence world, agencies will want to confirm information and assess sources by using several of them to gain access to the same information, thus corroborating or not each report, with the various sources being unaware of these alternatives, not always so in reality. One site that I do enjoy poring over is the US news site, realclearpolitics.com, which takes stories from the left, the center, and the right, and jumbles them together on its menu. You can skip around the stories and get a rapid idea of the completely different worlds in their heads that they must occupy in order to come up with such variations on a single story. The source can thus be assessed and put into the category that an independent analyst would place it into. More worryingly, computers now can do a lot more to accurately analyze habits, trace voices and words used, all crunched through behavioral analysis algorithms, and then spout out very accurate reports and predictions. You, dear listener, should be aware of these capabilities in the hands of the NSA, GCHQ, and the CCP, and in future, be able to better monitor and control such access and analysis using the people's veto. How do you think GIS would have fared? If every report for specific areas was looked at using this system, then GIS would have come out as an awful source, as every region had actively played with the data to fit a predetermined conclusion, that is, faked the data to situate the appreciation. In addition, the corroborating archive data from multiple locations would corroborate the criminal changes made in pursuit of satisfying the preconceived results required by the climate change clerisy. However, all of this indicates a criminal conspiracy to empty the pockets of the taxpayers and destroy livelihoods and lives around the world. Ultimately, they are taking lives, especially in the future when the economies across the West collapse and support for poorer nations is cut. No matter, the cult is happy. In the best case, this is evidence for a globalist power grab through the fascistic centralization of industries and commerce into the hands of a few, in the worst case, positioning for genocide. What assessment do you make of this example? Garbage in, garbage out. That doesn't change even when in support of a good cause. It is time to back the people's veto and stop them faking the future in support of a narrative that does not reflect reality and that science thing. It's only one vote away, but you need to do your bit to secure it.